All right. Well, did you get all of your grocery running about done?
Well, I got the order place. We do that thing where I do it on the phone and then drive over to Walmart and park in one of those nifty orange parking spots. And some lady who probably should have retired in 1970 brings it out to me. And I feel like horrible about the whole episode. Enjoy your Wheaties, Sonny. You know.
Thanks. Just throw it in the back for me.
And could you polish my fender while you're over there? Right.
You're already back there. Just take the hem of your dress if you don't mind there and take your wig off maybe to get a little buff.
I hear the fibers are great on Carnauba wax. I always think of Steve Martin, either his first or second comedy album back in the 70s. And at one point, he's talking about how mad he is at his mother. That he's like, she calls me up and she asks if she can borrow $5 to buy some food. I'm like, Ma, I'm not made out of money. But she's working it off. I had her put my barbells in the attic.
You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts. Neither of whom listened to Dear Old Mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
Well, sort of welcome back to the Good Sentences podcast. I'm Scott, and with me is...
Greg, or something like that.
As it's supposed to be. I always like to check to make sure the right person is on the other side.
You just never know.
Yeah, you never do. But that's what makes this so fun. So, the last time you and I got together, we were talking about character development, and specifically character motivation. And we had a lovely, stimulating conversation. Upwards of one person has listened to so far, so I'm pretty excited about that.
At least one
well, people. Did you listen to it?
Hell no.
I didn't either, so maybe none.
Not that kind of time.
No, I did listen to it because I always refresh my mind before I write the blog post to go along with the episode. So
yes, and I should say, if you don't listen to the episodes, at least read Scott's blog post because they are hilarious.
At any rate, we thought we would continue in the character development vein. The kind of development we're talking about today might not really appeal to most characters. We're hearkening to a quote that is usually attributed to William Faulkner, who, Craig, I have to add to our list of people whose profile pictures made me hate him immediately.
The
Wikipedia picture they have for him, you look at it and you're like, oh, he's a prick.
Oh, he's imminently punchable. Yep. Yes. Yep. And Hemingway would have loved to have done so.
Yes, he would have. And I would have loved to watch that happen. But the funny thing is that this quote, which is in writing, you must kill all your little darlings, probably wasn't originally his quote. After doing a little research on the old interweb, I found that it pointed to a fellow named Sir Arthur Conan. Nope, not at all. Arthur Quillen Couch. Over in England, they have lots of Sir Arthurs who are authors, apparently. But anyway, this guy was an author of such masterpieces as On the Art of Writing Lectures Delivered in the University of Cambridge, 1913 to 1914, which is a real page-turner, I'm sure.
Show off.
And he's the one who apparently originated that phrase. And in that same article where I learned of him, they're pretty adamant about the fact that he wasn't actually talking about murder of any kind, let alone of your characters, but rather of the author's responsibility to be brutal when revising their work. So in his mind, the little darlings are our words themselves, and to... produce a polished finished product, it's necessary to kill quite a few of them before all is said and done. So since we're talking about character, and pretty much as logic dictates, you would think it would refer to the act of killing your characters, that's what we're going to talk about, even though it has nothing to do with that in reality. When I was preparing my ideas for this, I was trying to remember, you know, the first book I ever read where a character death deeply affected me. I think the honest answer would have to be probably in high school when I first read the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and when Gandalf, as we think at that point, falls to his death. And it literally, I remember where I was in the art room because that's where I hung out most of the time. I don't know why, because I can't draw a straight line, but I was reading the book and that happened and it felt like I'd been punched in the gut. Literally, you know, I'm like, oh my God, Gandalf's dead. Of course, Tolkien hedged the bet by bringing him back to life. Spoiler alert. Sorry about that. Then there's another fantasy writer with way too many initials who is a little more recent and a little more in the news. And that's George R.R. Martin, who has no problem slaughtering just about everyone.
I'm pretty sure that's the only reason he writes. He just creates a ton of characters just so he can kill them later.
Right. I think he saw the quote and said, I'm in, man. This is it.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, when you talk about your first experience, in your case being Gandalf, I remember the first time I experienced that was also the first time that I cried at the end of a book. Uh-huh. And it was Martin Eden by Jack London. And at the end of the book, again, spoiler alert, I don't know if anybody else has ever even heard of the book, but at the end of it, the main character dies. And I'd gotten so invested and this character's success, because London did an amazing job of setting it all up. And it was just, put the book down. I was like,
yeah, right.
You know? And I didn't get over that. I'm not sure I'm still quite over it.
Right.
To be honest,
right.
This was many years ago. It is crazy how attached and connected we get with a fictional character on a page. And it just, I mean, that's truly a testament to how powerful literature is.
It is. And as writers, that connection can be even more deep because, you know, we're dealing with characters of our own creation. We've talked in the past about how these people, kind of in my mind anyway, are just as real to me as, say, you know, a Facebook friend I never met, except right. I probably know more about the character than I do about my friend. With regard to your own writing, are there any characters that you've killed off? I'm trying to think through your work, and I'm trying to remember.
There was one, well, I think there were a couple actually in the Serenity series. Mm-hmm. Fritz was one, Shelby's friend who dies in a horrific manner. So that was kind of tough to write.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the Spyco series, a prominent character that is killed off, mm-hmm. kind of Gandalf-y in more than one way, if you know what I mean, there. But there are definitely been a couple of times, and it's never easy. Like, it's something that I always struggle with. Mm-hmm. And do I really have to? Like, my tendency is to try to figure out a way around it.
Right.
And I spend the first few weeks or whatever trying to, like, to argue with it.
Could I just, like, give him really bad breath instead? How about that?
Right. I'll just make him really itchy. Yes, or get him or her as close to death as possible and then pull them back at the last second, right. You know, that kind of thing. But at some point, you know, it's rough. It's no joke. And those of you who are listening who are writers probably know exactly what we're talking about here.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I got to believe that any serious writer at some point in their career is going to have to deal with this at least once, you know. From experience, I would recommend getting yourself mentally prepared before you sit down at the keyboard for that, because it can be pretty intense to the writer themselves. And two examples from my work that come to mind are both from the Sarah of Quadar series, the fantasy series. Mm. And again, a little bit of a spoiler alert, but one of them is one of the, I don't know, I would say three or four top build characters in the whole series, whose right. death is foreshadowed in the first book and occurs in the third. And I hated myself as I was typing it, and I hated myself even more for foreshadowing it in the first book, so that I kind of had to.
And then, I hated you too when I read it.
And then the other character from there that dies, I'll go ahead and spill on this one, is Sarah's older brother, Beru. And that was a tough one too. Not as tough, because I wasn't as invested in him as a character as I was in aforementioned nameless character. It may have been more important as a plot device, because it happens essentially towards the end of Sarah's wizard training, but before she's completely wrapped her mind around her prophesied role in the whole planet's history. And that's pretty much the event that gets her where she needs to be.
At some point, a character can outlive their usefulness, mm-hmm. in a way. Okay, you're here. You've done what you're here to do. And now you can go.
Right.
I remember that death as being, it was a lot easier to take, but it also felt more inevitable or mm-hmm. something. Like, I totally rubber stamped it. Like, oh yes, this is okay. This
right,
is.
Right.
Whereas with the other character, it's like, oh my God. And both of those things, events added to the book, you're absolutely right. A character death can affect both the reader and the writer in different ways, even though they are just as important to the plot of the story.
Right.
Like, you don't necessarily have to hate yourself after the death of a character to have it be good for your story, but you just have to have a good a good enough grasp on the plot to know when to do it and to whom to have it happen.
Right. I mean, there definitely, if you're looking at it through the cold lens of the microscope, there's definitely some people who are essentially going to end up being fodder. Right. And, you know, there are some people who their deaths are a shock to you as much as to the reader, hopefully, at least as much to the reader. Right. It's like, I was shocked the reader didn't give a shit, but, you know.
Have you ever created a character with the sole purpose of killing them off later?
I did in a short story. It's in my book, Welcome Home, called The Hunters. Basically, two high school best friends who end up, let's say, brutally estranged from one another throughout most of their adulthood. And I knew from the moment I sat down to write this story that one of these guys was going to end up dead. It really ended up being the killer's story. The guy who was killed obviously was crucial to the whole thing, but it was told from the other guy's point of view. And I knew, you know, because even with my short stories, I'm kind of a by the seat of the pants guy a lot of the time. In fact, most of my novels started either as short stories or just as stupid ideas while I was parked in front of Home Depot. But that particular one, I'm like, I'm going to write a story about two best friends, one of whom kills the other. So, I do have to confess I have done that.
I probably do that more than I ought to. Like, all right, create a guy. Hello, guy. Your name is Corpse.
Right. Oh, yeah. And,
you know, victim.
Now that you've said that, I leave bodies all over the place in cleanup crew.
Right.
You know, so there's obviously people I put in there. Yeah, this guy's going to get it real quick, you know, or this guy's going to put up a little bit of a fight and then he's going to get it or whatever. But that's it. We're at the point now in cleanup crew where if you meet someone unpleasant, chances are they're going to die.
Right. Yeah. Here's what I'm nervous about with cleanup crew is that we're getting to the point in the series also where I'm not convinced of anybody's longevity.
Yeah.
It's getting to the point now where anybody could go, you know, and it makes me a little nervous.
Well, me too.
I imagine so. Like, oh, no. You get an email from your muse, like you don't want to open it. No.
Anything marked from your muse, it's just like delete, right. Delete.
I didn't get it.
I sent it 20 times.
No. Or you get your muse is like, why haven't you been either answering my emails or doing what I told you? And you're like, well, I didn't get any of the 20 ones you sent. Wait, oh, oops. Damn it.
That's in that same vein of bringing the note to your principal signed my mom.
Right.
Scott is a good boy and did not do this. Signed my mom.
But man, yeah, that happens across genres too. Like you mentioned the fantasy stuff, but one of the premier influences on me early on was a writer by the name of Alistair MacLean, and he wrote thrillers. And one book I remember of his, he did that. He killed off an important character who he had taken care, of course, to make every reader care about. Mm-hmm. And I was so upset at the end of the book that I made up a new ending and pretended mine was the real, like I rewrote the ending of the book in my head. I was like, no,
seems
this will
fair
not,
to me.
This shall not stand. I was probably like 10 or 11 years old or something.
It's good that you started asserting your authority at an early age in these matters. Right.
That's one thing that I think every writer at some point has to come to grips with. Whether it's actually killing characters or whether it's understanding that not every word that we write is gospel from on high, you trust your gut on things.
Right.
And you know, and that, of course, that kind of sixth sense will develop over time, too, as you gain experience as a writer. But don't be afraid to take action. Take some drastic action. You play it safe and your book's probably going to be pretty boring, to be honest with you.
It may end up in the run-of-the-mill folder.
Right. And yeah, no, you're totally right. I think that's one of the things, like the writer who is willing to make those difficult decisions, that is one thing that can set a mediocre book apart from a great book.
And, you know, another thing, too, I think for a writer who's towards the beginning of their career, I'm not going to say novice, but let's say someone who's got a few titles under their belt and has never really come up against, you know, that point in your career where, all right, this character's just going to die. It makes you a different writer after you've done it for the first time, if you get where I'm going.
Well, the first time I killed somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Sorry, but
let me rephrase that. The second time I killed. No, wait. No, that's no good either.
We're sitting live on the air here reevaluating our life decisions.
The management does not endorse or condone anything these two maniacs are saying.
This is another good thing about not having a corporate sponsorship. We never get away with this.
Really? And, you know, it's funny, too, because I'm thinking again of the cleanup crews in Nicole's backstory. She goes through a lot of really horrible stuff before she gets to the point where she is mentally at that springboard point where she can start taking her revenge. Mm-hmm. And it's a point in her life where, I mean, obviously you cross a line that you can never, you know, go back. But for her, it was almost like the natural next step for all the stuff she'd been through. But then you could just as easily have a character for whom, you know, that act, the act of killing another character would be so out of their character that the shock becomes doubled. Not only is this other character now dead, but the person who did it, what? You know?
And you mentioned something about it being like the natural next step. To me, that's a sign of a good plot when things become not predictable, but inevitable. And I think there's a difference between inevitability and predictability, where something happens and if it's inevitable, the reader's like, yes, okay, I totally buy that. Like, you don't want to be obvious and predictable.
Right.
But working inevitability is a sign of a good, tightly woven plot.
Harkening back to Nicole Porter again, up until the moment she makes that decision, I don't think the reader is 100% sure she's going to survive. You know what I'm saying? She was in a situation that could have just as easily meant her demise. And she just basically told herself, no, it's not going to play out that way. It's going to be this way. And a hardy career was born for her.
Right. Very lucrative.
Yes.
Or so they tell me. Well, I got to tell you, and I hate to admit this, but I have embarked on a life of crime. I have to be honest and admit that right here. But it is not through my own making. It's not something I did intentionally. Turns out my child, one of them, has been using me as a mule to shoplift. So one of the things we do every now and then, I take them to a local gas station here, and they can get treats. So I pick them up from school. We go over there, pick out like two or three things, and it's just sort of a little fun outing we do. Well, we did that a couple days ago. So we check out. And while I had been there checking out, I noticed that Christopher had stuck his hand in my pocket. And I just thought, you know, sometimes if my hands are busy and he can't hold my hand, sometimes he will just stick his hand in my pocket for comfort or whatever.
Sure.
So I didn't pay any attention. Well, I get home and in my pocket is a piece of candy that I don't think we paid for.
Oh, my goodness.
I think he had gotten I think I want an extra piece and had stuck it in my pocket.
See, the level of brilliance there is almost incomprehensible.
He didn't even try to sneak it out himself.
Right. Not only is he going to get what he wants, hopefully, but if he doesn't, you're the one going down.
Right, exactly.
He could just stand there and shake his head disapprovingly. He's like, Dad, where did you go wrong? So Andrew and I have done our best to raise you and look at you now.
So here I'm struggling, like, should I go back? Like, what do I do? And the thing is, I asked him, like, did you give this to the guy to scan? Because here's the other thing. While the checkout guy was checking everything out, I had gone to the counter immediately next to it and ordered fried chicken and stuff there too. Uh-huh. So I had gotten some chicken for lunch. So I wasn't there the entire time.
Right.
And so I asked, like, did they scan this? And he's like, yes, Daddy. And I couldn't double check it because I didn't get a receipt.
Right,
like the guy said, hey, you want a receipt? And I don't take it anymore because I don't need those little slips of paper all over the place.
Sure.
So I had no way to know. So I can't even double check. But I'm pretty sure I don't. Now that I'm thinking back on it,
my respect for your kids.
I think he used me.
Grown geometrically in the last couple minutes there. I mean, I like them anyway, but I'm a little in awe of them right now.
The kid's 5. What is he going to be doing at 7? Is he running con games? Like, you know, that book, Catch Me If You Can. He's going to be that guy.
It's like, Christopher, why are all those AK-47s in your bedroom?
I don't know, Daddy. I'm
holding them for a friend. They're not mine. Oh, excuse me. I have to take this call. Yeah, I can deliver 2 units.
Oh, God. So, yeah, it's getting real over here, people. So that's all that's been going on in my world. I'm going to try to get off this crime train as soon as possible. But raising twin boys, I don't know. It's, I might just have to go along for the ride.
Yeah, right. And hope for the best. Hope that, right. You know, you're visiting them in jail and not the other way around. I guess right. It's probably the best you can hope for at this point.
One of us is going. Yeah. It's just a matter of who.